had me a job down at the local mill. Work dried up, not a minute still. I can't pay my bills. The repo man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore.
Welcome to the Illinois World Labor Hour, and today we're going to have a little commentary as usual, labor headlines, as well as we have a special guest in the program. We're going to talk about a monumental event that happened almost a century ago. But first of all, you're listening to Illinois World Labor Hour on WFT. We're broadcasting on 90.1 FM from downtown Champaign, Illinois, and we're webcasting worldwide at www.weft.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the WFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay. Well, as I said, we have a special guest on the show today. The name is Professor James Barrett, and he's going to be talking about the 1919 steel strike. And this was, in his day, this was quite a monumental occurrence of labor strife. And anyway, before that, we're going to get to some contemporary news headlines.
A primarily smooth evacuation from the path of Hurricane Gustav turned sour last week as many New Orleans residents trying to return home were refused entry into the city at numerous roadblocks, which left many people stranded in public parking lots across the region. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin said Tuesday night that most residents would have to wait until Friday or later to come back because the electric power and medical care were not yet back to normal standards. At this point, there is also a nighttime curfew in the city. The unexpected delay left many people sweltering and frustrated at the city's edges, out of gas and money and food after several days on the move. Many of those who could not get back in were saying that a house without power was still highly preferable to another night of sleeping in their vehicles in a hot, crowded parking lot. Last Monday, New Orleans was spared the full force of Hurricane Gustav, which still knocked out power and down trees, but otherwise left most buildings in the city intact, the sewer largely functioning, and hospital emergency rooms open. The storm did not bring any serious flooding to the city itself, and not as much flooding as was initially expected in the coastal areas where it made landfall. According to some tents residents of the city, in spite of their uncomfortable segue, they were overwhelmed with relief when Gustav did not turn out to be another Katrina. A construction worker plunged some 400 feet to his death on Thursday as he and others were working to lower a tower crane at a building site on the west side of Manhattan. It was the latest in a series of high-rise accidents in recent months that have dogged Mayor Bloomberg's administration. This accident occurred about 9:30 a.m. as a team of seven men worked to lower part of a tower crane that had been used to erect a 58-story tower at 600 West 42nd Street, where developer Larry Silverstein is building the Silver Towers on the River, a 1,350-unit residential building scheduled to open next year. The worker was 48-year-old Anthony Esposito, a crane rigger and the father of three school-aged children. Deputy Fire Chief Anthony DeVita said Esposito was on a 20-foot working platform attached to the crane 40 floors up, and the platform apparently tilted, and Mr. Esposito lost his footing and fell. He was wearing a safety harness, but it was not attached to anything, according to Mayor Bloomberg's office. Authorities are trying to determine whether the platform was properly anchored, since it appeared to have been secured at only two points instead of four. A spokesman for the buildings department said the platform had been inspected on September 2nd, 2 days before the accident, but would not say whether it had been moved or altered since the inspection. The network in solidarity with the people of Guatemala has recently reported that union leader Antonio Morales, a former municipal council member of Colotenango and a Mayamam community leader in Huehuetenango in western Guatemala, was assassinated on the morning of August 7th. He was shot four times in front of his house on the Inter-American Highway near the Chanhon Bridge. On June 23rd, the municipality of Colotenango had become one of 26 municipalities to reject mining in their territory through community referendums. Morales had been actively opposing the mining since it was first suggested. In previous days, Morales had told people of threats made against him by armed groups that operated in the region. Intimidation and constant threats against human rights activists for their human rights defense work is common in Guatemala. Morales' assassination occurred one day before the International Day of Indigenous Peoples, which was on August 8th. On that day, rural communities and organizations had planned mobilizations throughout the country, particularly in western Guatemala and the Altos Cuchimatanes, to voice their resistance to such mega projects as hard metal mining and hydroelectric dams, and to defend their rights to autonomy and self-determination. The Environmental Protection Agency has announced new rules for small engines. Announcing what it called new surf and turf standards, the EPA on Thursday set stricter anti-pollution rules for engines that propel pleasure boats, lawnmowers, and weed trimmers. The agency said the rules would take effect in 2011 for lawn and garden equipment of 25 horsepower or less, and in 2010 for a wide range of inboard and outboard boat engines. Meeting the requirements will probably mean that catalytic converters, which are standard in modern cars, will become commonplace in lawn equipment and boats engines. The new rules, which were initially resisted by engine makers, are expected to make lawn equipment and boat engines somewhat more expensive, but EPA spokesman said the public health benefits would more than compensate for the initial consumer costs, and most, if not all, environmentalists agree. According to Vicki Patton of the Environmental Defense Fund, cleaner lawnmowers will mean less summertime smog and healthier air for many millions of our children, not to mention the rest of the population. And finally, the Service Employees International Union, the nation's fastest growing and most politically powerful union, said last week it was setting up a high-level ethics commission after some scandals at several of its largest locals. SEIU President Andrew Stern said that this commission would be led by an outsider and would establish tougher ethics rules that all of the union leaders would have to follow. Mr. Stern announced the commission 3 days after the president of a local in Los Angeles, representing 77,000 county workers, stepped aside amid accusations that her local had paid thousands of dollars to her former boyfriend. The announcement came 11 days after another Los Angeles local representing some 155,000 home care workers was placed into trusteeship because the local and its training center had paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to companies run by the wife, mother-in-law, and friends of the local's president. These revelations have come as Mr. Stern, who has ousted numerous corrupt union officials in the past, has been preoccupied with politics, unionizing more workers, and combining locals into larger, more powerful organizations. Actions that some critics say have led to less accountability for local leaders. Mr. Stern said the upcoming commission is expected to have 15 members, would consult with anti-corruption groups, including the Association for Union Democracy and Teamsters for a Democratic Union, and would discuss what ethics rules to adopt and how best to enforce them. Dave?
Yes, as a follow-up to that article, Tom, this is a press release from the Association for Union Democracy in Brooklyn, New York. In today's New York Times, the Service Employees International Union announced plans for an internal ethics commission to address recent corruption charges facing several top union leaders. The union indicated that it would consult the Association for Union Democracy as part of its efforts. The Association for Union Democracy is very willing to bring over 40 years of experience to bear in assisting the SEIU. But what the SEIU faces is a moral crisis involving both democracy and corruption. We believe it is essential to ensure protection for democracy and dissent within unions. Our experience shows that democracy is the linchpin for preventing corruption. An internal panel of the kind proposed by SEIU President Andrew Stern would simply mull over the niceties of a still another code and would be more than a waste of time. It would be an invasion. What the SEIU needs now is to establish a board composed of respected individuals, independent and completely outside the union power structure, a kind of Supreme Court endowed with power in defense of members' rights to overrule decisions of the International President and the International Executive Board in those circumstances in which members' democratic rights could be endangered.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Police raids that targeted activists and journalists at the Republican National Convention and resulted in the arrest of Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman are expected to trigger lawsuits. Anticipating that, though, a special deal was cut that required the Republican Party's host committee to buy insurance covering police liability up to $10 million. Michelle Gross of Communities United Against Police Brutality says this special insurance agreement means there's nothing to hold police back from using excessive force, since they won't be liable. Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman was arrested as she tried to question police about earlier arrests of Democracy Now! Journalists. Here's what it sounded like when Goodman was cuffed.
You are violating my constitutional right. You are violating
now.
Sir, I want to talk to you.
Arrest
him. Do not arrest him.
You're right there. He's under arrest. Stay right there. Back up, back up.
Hey, guys, if you cross this line, you'll be under arrest, so don't do it.
Amy, we're going to get you out of here
this
very
is
soon.
Outrageous.
Yes, we have people working on it.
Has a bloody nose, and Sergeant McKenzie said they won't put me on this.
Goodman is charged with misdemeanors, but the prosecutor's office in St. Paul is considering whether to actually press felony charges against two Democracy Now! Producers. Workers' rights were violated by a hotel in Waikiki, according to charges the National Labor Relations Board has agreed to hear. Jesse Russell reports.
The National Labor Relations Board agreed to open a hearing regarding charges by the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union that the owners of the Pacific Beach Hotel in Waikiki abused the rights of workers. The ILWU has filed numerous charges against the hotel, including one allegation that says the hotel fired all employees and ordered them to reapply for jobs. The union alleges that this was an illegal firing aimed at union activity. The hotel will respond to the allegations during a November 4th hearing. The charges date back to January of 2007.
Automobile workers in the Brazilian state of São Paulo went on a 24-hour strike on Wednesday. The 5,000 workers at plants that assemble vehicles for GM, Daimler, Toyota, and Mercedes-Benz walked off the job, demanding an 18.83% pay increase.
Here is today's economic report. Have you found yourself living paycheck to paycheck? You aren't quite in the majority, but a new study shows you are very close. The study by CareerBuilder.com reveals that 47% of Americans say they typically live paycheck to paycheck, and it isn't just those that make less than $100,000. The study showed that 21% who pull in $100,000 or more also live paycheck to paycheck. As a result, Americans aren't saving. 34% save less than $100 a month.
Get more labor news at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Those were the days we voted back.
doesn't amaze me that the Constitution is in tatters. No, nothing can faze me, cause my mind is like pancake batter. My vision is hazy, and I'm wishing that someone would save me.
Okay, folks, we're back. That was the song Demo Crazy. It was from a band, Theory of Everything. And this was a band that was composed of Paul Kottheimer, Darren Druda, and a few other people. And the title of the song, again, was Demo Crazy. I wanted to play that on benefit or on behalf of the, all those brave people in St. Paul, Minnesota this last week at the Republican National Convention who are both trying to report the real news. And I stress that again, the real news. And those who are on the streets defending our constitutional rights. And up in St. Paul, of course, it's made a lot of the headlines amongst the on the internet and the independent media. But the police were specifically targeting independent journalists, including beatings and arrest. Of those was Amy Goodman and two other reporters from Democracy Now. One of those reporters, a young woman, actually had her face slammed up against a car when she was trying to get out of the way of the police. The police had a series of protesters cornered in a parking lot. She had press credentials on. All these reporters have press credentials on with video cameras. They were obviously there reporting the news, and they were targeted and beaten just like somebody who tried to assault a police officer or whatever. But this is a very disturbing trend we're seeing here. And anyway, it's amazing when you go back in history. People think we've evolved a lot as a society. And you know, it's interesting because I got this over the email the other day. I guess just a couple weeks ago was the anniversary of women's suffrage in this country. And one thing I wasn't aware about was the police brutality against women who were demanding the right to vote back in the 19-teens. This is a story about our grandmothers and great-grandmothers. And, you know, they lived only 90 years ago. But remember, it was not until 1920 that women were granted the right to go to the polls and vote. The women were innocent and defenseless, but they were jailed nonetheless for picketing the White House, carrying signs for the vote. This is 1917. And by the end of the night, they were barely alive after they were put in jail. 40 prison guards wielding clubs and their warden's blessing went on a rampage against 33 women wrongly convicted of obstructing sidewalk traffic. They beat Lucy Burns, chained her hands to the cell bars above her head, and left her hanging there for the night, bleeding and gasping for air. They hurled Dora Lewis into a dark cell, smashed her head against an iron bed, and knocked her out cold. Her cellmate, Alice Kozu, thought Lewis was dead and suffered a heart attack. Additional affidavits describe the guards grabbing, dragging, beating, choking, slamming, pinching, twisting, and kicking the women. Thus unfolded the night of terror on November 15, 1917, when the warden at the Occoquan Workhouse in Virginia ordered his guards to teach a lesson to the suffragists in prison there because they dared to picket Woodrow Wilson's White House for the right to vote. For weeks, the women's only water came from an open pail. Their food, all of it colorless slop, was infested with worms. When one of the leaders, Alice Paul, embarked on a hunger strike, they tied her to a chair, forced a tube down her throat, and poured liquid into her until she vomited. She was tortured like this for weeks until word was smuggled out to the press. Well, folks, I think it looks like we're starting to make full circle in this country, and unless we start fighting back, we're going to be back to these kind of conditions for people merely getting out and defending their constitutional rights and wanting legitimate change in this country.
Yeah, Dave, did you hear the reports that the city of Minneapolis required the Republican National Committee to purchase insurance for the police, so police felt like they had carte blanche.
Yes, I heard it was for $10 million.
Yeah, they could go ahead and just do whatever they wanted to the protesters because they were covered by insurance.
Yeah, I mean, it's disgusting. And, of course, there was those preemptive raids against people that were just planning peaceful actions. I mean, granted, it was civil disobedience, but they were charged under terrorism laws. Terrorism laws. So if Martin Luther King was alive today in this country and would have and done some of the tactics he did in the South to get equal rights for black people, he would be locked up and charged as a terrorist. I mean, what have we come to in this country? What have we come to? People, wake up and fight back. Well, on a more somber note, we have come now to our distinguished guest here for the show, and his name is Professor James Barrett. Jim, welcome to the show today.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, listen, Jim, we had you. I was talking to you a while back, and we were talking about getting you on the show now for a while and everything. And you happened to mention that this is this week is the anniversary of the big 1919 steel strike.
Right. I think the actual date for the strike is September 22nd, so we're just coming up to it, and we thought we would talk about that a little bit.
Okay, well, I'm just going to turn you loose on that. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about the strike?
Great. I'm going to start with just a little bit of context because it helps to explain an event that otherwise is kind of hard to believe. In the course of the late 19th and early 20th century, both American industry and the labor force in the United States was really transformed. Industry through the introduction of mass production techniques and mechanization, and the labor force through two enormous movements of peoples. The first was the so-called new immigration, which brought a lot of European immigrants, millions of European immigrants, to the United States from Eastern Europe and from Southern Europe. And the second movement was what's usually called the Great Migration of African Americans from the Deep South. So what it meant is that from that point on, if you wanted to picture American industry, first of all, it looked very different. A lot more mechanization, a lot less skill, a lot more division of labor. And if you wanted to picture American workers, they looked very different. The working class was largely composed of immigrants and then increasingly of people of color, Mexican and African Americans coming into these industrial cities and towns. What this meant in terms of the labor movement, if you stop and think about that for a minute, is a new kind of labor organization. The old form consisted largely of craft unions. Most of the workers in those unions, the old AFL unions, were skilled white workers, either native-born or people from the old immigration. And what the new conditions and the new labor force required was a new kind of industrial organization, which I'll get back to in a second. The second thing to remember is that in this period, you have war conditions. And what this meant, on the one hand, was very high inflation. The estimates are around 100%. And this is over a fairly short period of a few years, and this is something that we're starting to face once again in the U.S. And the second thing that the war conditions meant was a severe labor shortage. I like to remind people that accountants and bankers don't fight wars. It's, for the most part, workers and farmers who do the fighting. And that's fine for the people running the war, except that you're taking a lot of your labor force out of your coal mines and factories and so forth. And so these newer people coming in were filling those positions, but there was a real labor shortage. Organizers out there will recognize this as a perfect situation in which to organize because there's tremendous pressure on people's wages on the one hand. The current example would be the 1.5% wage increase at the University of Illinois in the face of, so far, about 3.5% inflation, and that's probably going to go up. So that those are the kind of conditions that we're talking about. On the other hand, you had this labor shortage, so it's a good situation in which unions can come in and get people organized. Not coincidentally, then, there's a whole burst of organization that takes place during the First World War. And just to remind people, for U.S. Purposes, we're talking about 1917 and 1918, and an epidemic of strikes that breaks out during the war. 1919, which is the year of this big steel strike, is the key year. That's the year in which about one out of every four American workers went on strike. There's a big rise of radicalism. People may recognize that year, 1919, as the year in which the Communist Party in the United States was formed, and more importantly, a lot of different kinds of radicalism, labor parties, and so forth.
Was this also the year of the big Seattle general strike?
Right, yeah. The Seattle general strike gets a lot of attention because, in effect, once you had that complete strike of the city, workers rather than authorities were pretty much in control of the city, and something like the Soviets that they had in Russia during the revolution, and remember, we're pretty close to that. This is 1919, and the Russian Revolution took place at the end of 1917. That's the kind of organization that ran Seattle for a while. There's also a big, it wasn't just workers in Seattle, very surprising sort of groups. 1919 is the year of the Boston police strike. It's a largely Irish Catholic police force, and no one would have expected that to happen, but it suggests how far this sort of contagion of labor upsurge was going. And so the point is that it's within that setting, under those kinds of conditions, the needs for new organization in the midst of an epidemic of strikes, that you get the Great Steel Strike taking place. There's one more thing, one more ominous kind of thing that I should mention, which ends up playing a role in the strike. People that know the history of race relations in the United States may recognize that 1919 is also the year of widespread race riots in the United States. Chicago had the big one, but there were actually riots in dozens of cities and towns across the country. And what this does is raise the issue of organizing across racial lines. In other words, whether you're going to be able to do that or not. So what I wanted to do was to just very briefly just read a paragraph or so. This is from the last book that I did. It's a biography of William Z. Foster, who ran this organizing in the steel industry. But these paragraphs don't have anything to do with him. It just kind of gives you some idea of what the place looked like at the time and what was happening. Dominated by United States Steel, one of the largest and most modern corporations in the world, the steel industry seemed unbeatable. The power of the corporation extended beyond the plant's walls into the mill towns, where it often controlled housing, local politicians and police, and even cultural and recreational facilities. Presiding over the Steel Trust was Judge Albert Gary, an imposing figure, eloquent, dignified, iron-willed. Philosophically, Gary was firmly wedded to the notion of the open shop. In practice, the corporation regularly fired activists and maintained elaborate blacklists to keep them out of its plants. To trade union organizers, William Foster wrote, the steel industry had long symbolized the impossible. The workers, for their part, appeared to be hopelessly divided and in disarray, composed of literally dozens of nationality groups and people from vastly different backgrounds and experiences. The labor force was also segmented along skill lines, with native-born British and Irish craft workers often despising the unskilled immigrant hunkies. How could such an organizing task possibly succeed? And yet it did. National Committee for Organizing Iron and Steel Workers swept hundreds of thousands of workers into unions in the course of 1918, and they tried, like a lot of unions do, to actually avoid a strike. It was not so much because they were afraid, but because they didn't want to jeopardize this organization that they had put together. But the United States Steel Corporation was absolutely adamant. President Wilson, president during the period of the war, tried to intervene, but the steel corporations wouldn't move. And so what happened was that in the course of September, when it became clear that a strike was going to take place, you saw little stickers beginning to appear in mill towns throughout the United States in various languages, not just in English, but also in Italian and Polish and Romanian and Hungarian and so forth. And all the stickers said was strike, September 22nd. And this was the beginning of the steel strike. It takes off on September 22nd. And I'll just say a few more words about it, and then Dave may have questions about what all this means. So on that date, September 22nd, we're talking about a strike of a quarter million, 250,000. These are men for the most part. This is heavy industrial work, which has few women involved at that point in time. To give you some idea, that was about half of all steel workers in the United States. They walked away from their jobs. It was the largest individual industry labor conflict up to that point in the history of the United States. And the more importantly, it was a moment that everybody recognized. In other words, this was a new kind of labor organization. They were facing one of the most powerful open shop industries in the United States, corporations in the United States. And so the strike threatened not only productivity and profits, but it also threatened an entire labor management philosophy, that is the open shop. And just this next short portion is just meant to give you an idea of some of the conditions in the mill towns during the strike. This is also from the book on Foster. Repression began immediately and was the worst in the Pittsburgh district. The companies built stockades, strung barbed wire around the mills, and placed machine guns at strategic points to supplement the local police and deputies and the dreaded state constabulary. Steel officials imported thousands of heavily armed people who they called detectives to intimidate the steel workers. Foster said, along the Monongahela River from Pittsburgh to Clarendon, a distance of 25 miles, there were not less than 25,000 armed men in the service of the steel trust. The steelworkers desperately fought it out on the streets of the mill towns where the strike was suppressed with considerable brutality from start to finish. Even before the conflict had begun, police systematically attacked open meetings. On Sunday, September 21st, 1919, in Clarendon, Pennsylvania, this is a wonderful old mill town, 15 miles up the river from Pittsburgh, thousands of immigrant workers and their wives and children had gathered in an open field to hear plans for the strike set to begin the following morning. The crowd was listening to union leaders when half a dozen mounted state police charged into the audience at full gallop, cursing and flailing with their nightsticks at the screaming men, women, and children. Speakers who had discouraged the strikers from stoning the police were arrested, held without charge, and finally booked for disorderly conduct. It was the beginning of the terror in the Pittsburgh district. The union's early civil liberties work, they organized for a long time to be sure that people would be able to speak freely on street corners. This civil liberties work was now ruthlessly swept away. Allegheny County authorities banned any public meeting of three or more people in an outdoor public place. Even indoor meetings were permitted only in English and strictly at the discretion of local authorities, most of whom prohibited gatherings of any sort. The county sheriff deputized 5,000 vigilantes who had been selected, paid, and armed by the steel companies, most of them businessmen and ex-soldiers. The results were predictable. On August 26th, at Brackenridge, Pennsylvania, deputies led by a mine official charged a group of pickets in a mill yard, shooting as they came. One of the people that was killed at this time was a woman by the name of Fanny Sullins, grandmother. Her son had served and had been killed in France during the First World War, and she was attacked by the police and killed and became kind of a symbol. Another symbol during the strike, I should mention, is Mother Jones. Some people may recognize Mother Jones's name from a lot of different labor conflicts and organizing at the time. She's in her 80s. This is kind of towards the end of her life, and she's an active organizer. She's going around to the various mill towns and giving public talks and so forth. So the idea here is that on one side you have this tremendous kind of militarized force in the steel mill towns, but on the other hand you have this very powerful union organization, which by this time has got, you know, close to 300,000 steel workers out on strike. So let me know what else you want to know about this steel strike.
Was the strike successful?
No, the strike lost. I would love to tell you that the strike was successful, but it lost. And this is another important part of the story, because it was not only, if you think about this date now, the war is over. you're just kind of coming out of the influenza epidemic of 1918. They couldn't hold public meetings during that time because of the flu epidemic. But also the government has started canceling all of its war contracts, so unemployment's going up. The point is that you're sort of tipping into a period when organizing conditions from a labor perspective are much less promising. So that's part of the reason. This tremendous violence is another part. Often when they arrested steelworkers, and they arrested thousands and thousands of them during the strike, they gave them a choice. They could go to prison or they can go back to work. And so it gives you some feel for the pressure that was on people. The other thing that's very important about your question that goes back to the introduction that I gave to the strike is that the organizers were very successful in the immigrant communities. The immigrants just signed up by the thousands. These are people who had never been approached by unions before, but they were ready. They were ready to organize, and they were ready to strike. The immigrant communities were extremely solid during the war. This includes churches, other sort of cultural institutions. Everybody in the immigrant community seemed to be supporting the strike. The problem was that more and more black workers were coming into the industry, and in fact, thousands were systematically imported into the mill towns as strike breakers. And this is a complicated issue. I won't go into the whole thing, but just to remind people what was at stake here, black workers had been systematically barred from unions for more than a generation now. Union workers had been involved in various at various points in time in violence against black workers, and so it was a rather sort of inauspicious kind of organizing environment that the organizers faced for the African American workers. But the point from a strategic point of view is that with a lot of unemployment setting in now, with few other job opportunities left open to blacks who were often excluded from jobs in a lot of parts of American industry, black workers were brought in as strike breakers. This not only helped to break the strike, but it also introduced the issue of racial conflict into these towns, and it helped to sort of divide what otherwise would have been a unified labor movement.
Divide and conquer, the classic tactic, yes,
right.
Indeed. But this did, now from my understanding of this this whole 1919 steel strike was, though, although it wasn't successful at this point, that it did do paved the way for the later success of the 1930s.
It paved the way in a lot of different ways. I mentioned at the beginning that the old craft unions were completely worthless in the context of mass production industry. You can't do that. There's no way that you can organize a labor force of 500,000 people in the steel plants into 100 different craft unions. That's not going to work. And so instead, they took a step. It was a very complicated sort of organizing structure that they used, because the craft unions are all still there. But they used this national committee almost like an industrial union. And to remind people, what we mean by an industrial union is everybody in the plant. It doesn't matter what somebody is doing, if the person's a carpenter, if they're a bricklayer, if they're an electrician, or if they're an unskilled mill worker, blast furnace worker, laborers that moved metal around, and so forth. Everybody has to be in the union. Everybody that walks through the door is in one union.
But that's not including management, of course.
No. No, that's the big division, and in fact, foremen, you know, even the sort of lower level management were not in the union. So that's kind of the class division that we're talking about. But there's one more point that I wanted to make about this. So the connection with the 30s that Dave just mentioned is, it's the industrial form of organization that sweeps through American industry in the next generation. It's the form of organization that was pioneered in the context of the 1919 steel strike that wins in the late 30s and the period of the Second World War. The second issue is this issue of race and also other kind of social differences among workers. Eventually, it wasn't a perfect movement by any means, but eventually the CIO unions breach, cross a lot of those sort of social divisions and sweep up very large numbers of African American and unskilled immigrant workers into their ranks. And it's both the strategic sort of breakthrough that you have during the strike, a mass strike by effectively an industrial union, and also the social breakthroughs that you have beginning to cross those sorts of ethnic and racial lines that really comes to fruition in the CIO period and wins the big strikes for the CIO.
Okay, Jim, listen, if you can stick around,
yep,
we'd like that. We're going to go now to Tom Thomas's poem of the week. And this week, his poem is Common Sense. Where have I heard that before?
Now, we have all got to want to do all the things we have to do, so our world will not be through, and we must do it as a crew. The hurricanes battering us are one small sign of what's to come, as global warming sneaks on up, though still is denied by the dumb. Or maybe they're not really dumb, maybe they just don't really care, contaminating our water and poisoning our very air. The abundance of fossil fuel burning away our very sky should make us see and make us know it makes entire species die. We are the species who can save this lush green orb that we live on by just using some common sense and with burning carbon be done. We have the wind to service us to generate electric power, and we can control the sun's rays so our earth again may flower. But we have all got to want to do all the things we have to do before our very world is through, and we've got to do it as a crew. Common Sense was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois, September 3rd, 2008, and was first broadcast live September 6, 2008 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Community Radio for East Central Illinois.
Thank you, Tom. And some public service announcements. We'd like to let the listeners know that tomorrow is WEF Fest. Tomorrow, Sunday, from 2 p.m. to 11 p.m. out in front of WFT Station on North Market Street. And that'll be, again, from 2 to 11 p.m. And our address here on North Market is 113 North Market. So half the street of Market, the two blocks of Market Street, will be blocked off between University and Park. So turn out for that. There'll be a lot of great bands playing, as well as the usual food and other items. Our healthcare system is broken. It may be working for greedy insurance and drug companies, but it's sure not working for workers, retirees, or employers. What ails the system can't be fixed at the bargaining table. We must elect candidates who will reform our nation's healthcare system so that we have healthcare we can count on. But do you know what the candidates are proposing? This is from the Communication Workers of America. They've developed a fun tool to help you learn about Barack Obama and John McCain's healthcare plans. The Communication Workers of America Healthcare Challenge puts the candidates on stage as you match each candidate to the policy he supports and identify which policies support CWA's principles for healthcare reform. Play the game now. The results may surprise you. And you can go and check this out at www.healthcarevoices, all one word, that's healthcarevoices.org. And also, we have another local event here I wanted to let our listeners know about. It's a panel discussion. PTSD, our troops, our community. War has been described as hell. This has never been made more evident than by the large number of men and women who currently suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, as a result of their military experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. Learn about this little understood trauma of war and its effect on lives of people living in our community. You can find out about this on Sunday, September 7th. That's also tomorrow at 2 p.m. at the Urbana Free Library Auditorium. Again, that's tomorrow, 2 p.m. at the Urbana Free Library Auditorium.
Billionaires for Bucks.
Now, it's time for this billionaire moment.
Give a small child a knife, and the poor tyke is likely to chop off a finger. But in the hands of a master chef, that same knife is a tool for creating a magnificent, sumptuous feast. It's the same thing with money. Give money to poor people, and they'll probably squander it on foolish indulgences like aluminum siding, or medicine, or food. But if you put money in our hands, in the hands of people who have been around money all our lives, we're going to use that money to build empires and buy elections and develop weapons systems and suppress dissent and spread the blessing of unbridled corporate power all over the world. I'm Zena Phobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here comes the billionaire!
This is from the New York Times of October 8, 1985. Sir Kenneth Newman, the Commissioner of Police for Metropolitan London, who commands a force of 27,000, said he had intelligence reports that anarchists and Trotskyites had fomented the series of riots that has plagued Britain since violence erupted in an inner city area of Birmingham called Handsworth on September 9. The anarchists and Trotskyists are out fomenting riots. Sounds a little silly, but the stupid Brits will buy it. Unemployment, apathy, no future down the line, while our upper class governors lead lovely lives of crime. Some kill with plastic bullets, some with a plastic pen. Who's fooled by plastic music, who won't be fooled again? And here come the levelers, true levelers. They dance on Greenham Common with the shelly circling revelers. And I see General Ludd laughing through the fire, while Ellie, Marx, and Marley mix memory and desire. And here come the levelers, the levelers, the levelers. They're plotting in the common with the crazy hippie revelers. And I see General Ludd, he's dancing through that fire, while Tushy, Marx, and Marley mix politics and desire. Come the levelers, the devilers, the revelers, to claim the urban wilderness before desire tire. And here come the levelers, true levelers, those revelers, to see the heart of darkness before desire expires.
There once was a rocker girl with a freak flag to unfurl and a puppet show on the WTO with a message that intended to change the world. She'd go to the center of town where her comrades were locked down, and she never was afraid when the pepper spray sprayed. She always stood her ground. She'd sing, "You can't catch me, I'm running with the black block. Stuff your crotch with a tube sock. Copper, I'm running with the black block. No, you can't catch me, I'm running with the black block. And I'll be running with the black block till the revolution is nigh, till the day I die." Now this rebel girl gets crass when she's caught a whiff of the old tear gas, with the radical cheer against the riot gear that goes zaka baka soda cracker kiss my ass. And tough as it may seem, she will go to the extreme, till an end to oppression with no concession is more than just a dream. She'll sing, "You can't catch me, I'm running with the black block. Stuff your crotch with a tube sock. Copper, I'm running with the black block. No, you can't catch me, I'm running with the black block. And I'll be running with the black block till the revolution is nigh, till the day I die."
Okay, we're back, and you heard a couple of songs. First of all, we had a billionaire moment, which was Billionaires for Bush. Bill Grell used to play those on the air quite often, and I happened to run across this one I thought was especially appropriate, considering what's been going on this week. And the last song you heard was Paul Kottheimer's song called Radical Cheerleader. And I wanted to dedicate that to all the young women, as well as young men, but young women in particular that are up in St. Paul this week, standing up to the riot police. So, Bob, do you have something for us?
Yes, Dave, about the Boeing situation. Despite a 48-hour contract extension, negotiations between Boeing Company and machinist union officials failed Friday, and the union said a strike began at 12:01 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time Saturday. When the talks broke off, the union sent out a message to members saying, "The strike is on." The company said it would not try to assemble planes during the strike. Boeing spokesman Tim Healy said the company is open to further discussion, but both sides were too far apart to reach agreement. He added no additional talks were scheduled. The machinists bargained for about 25,000 aircraft assembly workers in the Puget Sound area and about 2,000 more in Wichita, Kansas and Portland, Oregon. Union members on Wednesday voted 80% to reject Boeing's final three-year contract offer and 87% to go on strike, mainly over job security. Both sides agreed to the extension at the request of Governor Chris Gregoire and federal mediators. Negotiators for Boeing and the Machinists Union jetted off to the Disney Resort in Florida for talks following the extension, in part so Tom Buffenbarger, International Association of Machinists International President, could participate. Buffenbarger was at the resort for an IAM convention. And Tom Robluski, President of Machinist District Lodge 751, declared in a statement that Boeing had disrespected the finest aerospace workers anywhere on the planet by failing to meet machinist expectations. And despite meeting late into the night and throughout the day, continued contract talks with Boeing Company did not address our issues, he added. Boeing's best and final three-year offer, presented August 28th after talks that began May 8th, included bonuses totaling at least $5,000 and averaging $6,400, raises averaging 11%, pension increases, and a 3% cost of living adjustment were offered, according to the company. The average Boeing machinist earns $27 an hour, or about $56,000 a year before overtime and incentives. Analysts have said a strike could cost Boeing about $100 million per day in deferred revenue. During the last strike, a 24-day walkout in 2005 that was one of the shortest in company history, Boeing was unable to deliver more than two dozen airplanes on schedule.
Okay, we'll stay tuned and see what happens. Okay, Professor Barrett, Jim, I should call you. We're talking about the 1919 steel strike here and everything, and this comes from the book William Z. Foster that you wrote. Tell us a little about writing about this book. I mean, you worked on this for quite some time, didn't you?
The reason I got interested in it, this guy, William Z. Foster, was that most people remember him backwards. He emerged as a real Stalinist and kind of the major figure in the Communist Party in the United States, and so people remember that part, and that's important. But he started out his life as a remarkably brilliant labor organizer. This was not the only organizing campaign that he was involved with, the 1918-1919 steel campaign. He also organized the stockyards in Chicago. That was organized very successfully. Organization there sustained over a long period of time and included a lot of these black and new immigrant workers. So I was interested in kind of the whole story, how you go from a guy with a third grade education and a real industrial worker who's actually a hobo for parts of his life to become kind of a labor intellectual and a very effective organizer and the leader of the Communist Party in the United States. So that's kind of what the book is about.
Okay. Well, the industrial model as well as wasn't the first pioneering the strike. I mean, the industrial workers of the world had used it, and it probably even predates them.
Yeah. This is not a coincidence. Foster was basically a syndicalist. What that means is all attention on the point of production and industrial over political organization. He was not very interested in political affairs and electoral politics, and so he actually spent a good time in the IWW and was an organizer and an activist for them. So you're right that he's carrying over some of the industrial union concept from the earlier organizations like the IWW especially into the period of the First World War and then eventually into the period of the CIO.
But if I remember right from reading your book, was that one thing that was kind of a little bit of an epiphany with him was that he realized that the political aspect of it was important, and the industrial internal organizing model, if you will, was only one leg of the stool, if you would, because of the brutality they suffered at the hands of the local authorities, the police, and that somehow there could have been a political organizing activities done. They could have at least tempered that a little bit.
Anyway. All right. When the strike is done, he's an extremely practical guy in many different ways. And when the strike is lost, he sits down and writes a book, which is it's called The Great Steel Strike, and it's the lessons that he drew from the strike. This is probably number one. And what he observed was that without a strong sort of what he called a militant minority, kind of a left core within the labor movement, it's really going to be impossible to win these kind of strikes. And a lot of it has to do with what you're talking about. In other words, the state, even if you're just talking about, even if the state means, you know, the sheriff in a mill town, you're basically talking about government. Was consistently on the side of employers, and that just hobbled strikes throughout the late 19th and the early 20th century. And one of the things you'll find during the period that you talked about earlier, when this organizing was successful with the CIO, is that they're very involved in politics. There's a lot of, in some cases, it's independent labor parties that are organized. In other cases, they support the New Deal Democratic Party. And then it's one of the few points in the nation's history where this is true, but in the 1930s and 1940s, even the Communist Party, which would kind of represent the left wing, was actually pretty influential in some of these unions. So he did make that observation, has a lot to do with why he became a communist, and even for those of us that don't subscribe to that political ideology, what it does seem to suggest is that you can't really ignore politics.
And of course, the Communist Party... prior to the 1940 Hitler-Stalin Pact, was a lot of people were involved in it. I mean, a lot of people, like, for instance, Harry Kelber, who calls in and contributes to our program occasionally with interviews and also his weekly labor column, himself was a member of the Communist Party as a young man. But as he stated, he didn't care what went on about Russia or Lenin or anything. That to him, it was from his observations about who the people were on the ground who were fighting for his standard of living and others that were members of this American Communist Party that was what turned him that. And of course, a lot of people left the Communist Party in the United States after the crimes of Stalin were starting to reveal. And of course, we could do a whole program
about right.
that.
That's right. That's what I would suggest. Bring me back and I'll tell you all about
that.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. And thank you for tuning in to the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT. And please tune in next week.